devastating, but there are things you can do to limit the effects of all types of emergencies.
Visit ready.gov to learn how to take simple steps to prepare for emergencies.
A little advanced planning can help keep you and your family safe.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the Ad Council, and this station.
Hi, this is Tom from the Lost Highway Show, wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas and a happy and healthy New Year.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. This is Saf, and you are listening to the WHFR Dearborn Station, the station that's making waves, 89.3 FM, right here off of the HFCC campus in Dearborn. The show is called The Poetry Hour. The Poetry Hour is for you to listen to some poetry, understand a little bit more about poetry and poems, and know a little bit of a history about poetry. We are interviewing today a professor from HFCC College. His name is Jay Kornick. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Fine. Thank you for inviting me, Safwan.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here. And we are looking to an interesting show today in poetry and the poetry field. Well, to begin with, we would like you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background on the campus, in the station, and so on. Please.
Sure. Well, actually, I've worn many hats at many different tasks here at Henry Ford Community College, where I've been employed full-time and now retired, employed part-time for over 42 years. So in my first career here at Henry Ford, I was hired as a full-time member of the English division, and I taught English composition and literature classes for 14 years, from 1968 to 82. My academic preparation was in that vein too. I had my undergraduate work done at Oakland University here in Rochester, Michigan, and was almost a double major there, English and French, as a matter of fact, too. And then I went on to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where I got a master's degree in comparative literature, which involves literature, literary sources other than English. And my specialties were Japanese and Russian and French literature, as well as, of course, English and American, too. When I came here to Henry Ford in the English department, I also was very interested in starting a creative writing class, and I did help get that class started in 1970, was one of the key teachers here in for the next decade of creative writing. Sometimes we had as many as three or four sections in one semester. So besides teaching poetry as literature in other classes, I also was able to teach creative writing to people, and that was very exciting. That was a wonderful thing at the time. And then I got more interested in the mass media, in what was called mass communication then, radio and television, which was a burgeoning creative field as it is today. So I began working on a second master's degree at Wayne State University, finished that about 83, and then was also in the process of creating the telecommunications department here at Henry Ford Community College, which I was the lead teacher of from the 80s all the way until my retirement last year. So the telecom program, as well as WHFR-FM, were the things that kept me busy in my in my last major career area. I didn't haven't taught English since 82, but I still love poetry.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very interesting. You have a real great history of knowledge. You're like a library walking, huh?
Yeah, I've got the books to prove it at home, so.
Cool, that's very interesting. So when you think of poetry, what is exactly poetry to you personally?
Well, poetry is made up of language, and it's, to me, the use of language is most intense, most thought-provoking, most challenging, most expressive in the form that one could call poetry. If they say that, I think this is Shakespearean, brevity is the soul of wit, certainly poetry is full of wit. It's wit forward, backwards, inside out. It's succinct, it's powerful, it's almost magical. And there's other kinds of definitions that involve different types of poetry, different forms and whether it rhymes or not, and we can talk about that later. But in fact, I think of it as the most compacted and intense form of language that there is.
Nice. Can you give us the history of poetry, a little bit of an education, a background of what poetry is?
Well, as you're aware, poetry goes back to the beginnings of our existence as human beings on this planet. We believe there was oral traditions of poetry right from the beginning. There is some evidence of both hieroglyphics and some writing of not complete sentences, but obviously a sort of a poetic or symbolic use in the earliest cave paintings and cave etchings that we have on this planet. And that goes back about 20 to 40,000 years. So there's no doubt that this is something that's been done since the beginning of human history. I think it's interesting to note, too, that although the Iliad and the Odyssey, a lot of people are familiar with that, those poems, very long poems, if you read them in a book, they tell two very basic stories that are part of the cultural traditions of cities in Greece. Mm-hmm. And they talk about Greek gods and also human beings, and they talk about the values of their society. They were used, apparently, first of all, to teach all the young people of their society, as they were growing up, these important lessons about how to live one's life. So it was the stories that were being told over and over, decade to decade, century to century, that the Iliad and the Odyssey represent. So they're large, single stories, but they were passed along as an oral tradition, not written down for hundreds, if not maybe as much as 1,000 years. I think the Iliad and the Odyssey began somewhere around 800 to 675 BC. Wow. That's almost 3,000 years ago. Although about 3,000 BC, we do have the cuneiform tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I think that might have been the earliest epic poem, very great story, culturally based, from the area of Mesopotamia, which is today Iraq, and again, that's 3,000 BC, so it probably predates the Greek tradition, the Western traditions that are demonstrated really in the Iliad and the Odyssey. And all through the ages, poetry has taken many different forms, very much culturally dependent. The poetry that works in one country, is successful in one country, and it's not necessarily a language thing, because even in the best of translations, it's not necessarily as communicative to people in another country. So there's social traditions, there's political traditions, as well as, of course, language usage, and obviously foreign languages can't translate perfectly from one to the other. So there's a little bit of the history. There are many different types and forms. Some have rhyme, rhythm, either external or internal. Some have a form or a shape, and others don't. They can be a very long length, like the epic poems I just mentioned, or extremely short. Haiku is an example of a Japanese tradition of very, very short, intense uses of language. Some of them are more prose-like. In fact, depending on your definition, a short story, you have a paragraph or less, which is still nonetheless a beginning, middle, and end, can be referred to as a poetic work. So some of them I've even read, even Robert Frost, American poet Robert Frost, had elements of dialogue in his poetry. So elements of dramatic, there is theatrical elements can be part of poetry too. So it's many different traditions, very culturally dependent, however.
Nice. That's a detailed information that we are listening here, folks. You are listening to the WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and this is the Poetry Hour. We are interviewing Mr. Jay Kornick from the HFCC staff, we are talking, getting into more details about what poetry is and the history of poetry for those of you who are interested in poetry and would like to know a little bit of history and just basically information about poetry. And Mr. Jay, one more time, what would be your favorite form or type of poetry?
Well, it's very difficult to look at that, and thank you for giving me the questions you're going to ask me in advance, because it allowed me to get only 2 hours sleep last night as I was going through all my books and trying to answer that particular question. I think I narrowed it down to maybe about 10 or 15 poets, and in general, and maybe I can give some examples or read some examples for the listeners later, but in general, I realized that what most affected me was poets that I had read and studied from high school through college, through my years of teaching English here. And so that's from like 1960 through about the 1980s. I think also the reason that some of these people are my favorites is because I got a chance to meet many of them and talk to many of them and hear them read their poetry themselves. So I'll just mention some names from that period. Let's see, name dropper that I am. Allen Ginsberg, I briefly met and was able to hear him read Howl, which is great classic contemporary poem of his from the 1950s, epic poem. Gary Snyder, who was another of the so-called beatnik poets along with Ginsberg, although kind of went beyond them into sort of California backwoods kind of writing and Japanese poetry. Robert Frost, of course, great poet. A lot of people underrate, I think, Robert Frost. I think he was a very cagey old man, and his poetry is much deeper than most people would probably accept at the outset. Also in the 60s, some poets that some other people hadn't maybe become connected with. Richard Brautigan is a special favorite of mine. I have several of his collections with me here. Before that, though, way back, the so-called classic poets, certainly the modern era of poetry was greatly influenced, and these are my favorites in that group, by Gerald Manley Hopkins in the late 19th century, T.S. Eliot in the early 20th century, and Walt Whitman, of course, in the late 19th century. E.E. Cummings also was a significant breakthrough poet in the 1920s with, he's most remembered as the poet who didn't capitalize anything. That's not true. He did capitalize a few words, but not where you would expect. Mm-hmm. In fact, his own name, E.E. Cummings, he always wrote it, so in all of his books, with no capital letters. Pretty radical, huh?
Significant.
Again, it was a sort of a modern breakthrough, is that certain rules or standards, especially in poetry, may not be so important anymore. Let's explore beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for that nice breakdown. We look at poetry and we look at the uses of poetry, and I know you mentioned a little bit briefly when you were talking about the history of poetry and when it was used. When and why would poetry be used back when it started until today, and what would be the occasions or the uses for it, please?
Yeah, I think it really is a key question, and maybe more so today for our listeners, because poetry, I think, is less experienced in its written or spoken form today as pure poetry. I think it's mixed in all of our media, popular music. There's lyrics, and some people say those lyrics are like, rhyming poems in many cases. Sometimes they don't rhyme. I think popular songs and any music that has lyrics with it that's written currently is probably the closest the majority of people get to experiencing a poetic language. And for the most part, most of the songs work because of the musical arrangement, instrumentation, and that performance, not the power of the words by themselves, I'm sorry to say, although I've always thought that classic singer-songwriters of the last 20, 30 years, like Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen, had, particularly brilliant lyrics. Many of them could almost stand alone in terms of their poetic effect. Nonetheless, the use of poetry, I think it's important to go back and remember that as far as we can tell, the first use of poetry, the first and the most powerful use of language as it developed in the human species and human culture was probably for power, for magical power, to gain power over nature, to gain power over other people. And so magical incantations and rituals, even today, many religions use the power of repetition, the names of God, and the various divine saints, holy people that support them, in these ritual settings, community ritual settings that are repeated weekly, if not, monthly, at least. So that connection of the use of poetry for getting control over our world, of being more powerful, of being able to involve ourselves or invoke God or a godhead of some sort, is quite amazing to me. And poetry seems to have that kind of magic about it. I'm not saying that a successful work of art in any other form couldn't also approach that. It could. But imagine, poetry is just words.
Mm-hmm.
But in a very, very carefully selected words in a very particular order. And that's all it takes. You don't need a fancy building. You don't need musical accompaniment. You don't have to have a cast of thousands or technology, computer graphics. All it takes is words, and you can approach Godhead. And I say that in regard to all religious beliefs, that language is a part of the ways that you involve yourself with the spiritual entity or entities that are part of those religious beliefs.
So would you say that poetry could be achieved by learning it, or is it a God-given thing that people get?
Well, it's the old question at the start of a creative writing class. Many people taking that would say, I don't think I can write poetry. I mean, I'll give it a try, but, am I going to fail the class if I can't be writing great poems? And, of course, we say the class is about creativity. It's about exploring your potential. And is it inborn? Can poetry or great writing be taught? Teachers would probably say, yes, there's some elements of context that can be taught, the form, the rhythm, the rhyme. If you want to use those elements, there's technical things you can learn, and it can make a collection of words more powerful to follow the traditional forms that have already, or rhyming patterns that have already been used before. So I'd say everyone could be a better poet if they worked at it and if they studied and read other poetry. Perhaps the best is quite rare, however, mm-hmm. And that's almost by definition, is that art is, by some people, is it cannot be done by everybody. It's only elitist. It's only a few people because, you know, the greatest things, well, they can't be that common. If they're very common, it's no good. I don't really accept that. I never have. The Japanese culture celebrates once a year, and I think it's around our, or maybe around their New Year's Day, that traditionally it's a time when every single person is supposed to sit down and write a poem. It's kind of like we do New Year's resolutions here in the United States. You know, it's going to be a new year. Well, write down the things that you want to be better, things you want to do or things you don't want to do. Make a resolution, write a list. Well, they write poems, supposedly. Now, I don't know, since I haven't been in Japan and I haven't talked to any close friends for a long time who've been in Japan, I don't know how much that's still followed. Pop culture is so distracting, you know, the movies, the TV shows, the constant media barrage, that I doubt many people have the time to sit down quietly and write out anything creative. You know, that moment of inspiration can't just be turned on and off like a spigot. but I have several poets here that, well, I could mention the poems of people besides the popular lyrics in popular songs, which I say are pseudo-poetry anyway, some of them coming close to poetry. We know that there's poets that very inspirational, positive, philosophically based poets that a lot of people like to read. Rumi, Khalil Gibran, I'm trying to think of some others too. I have Peter McWilliams here, who actually grew up in, I don't have him here, he passed away a couple years ago, but he got his start in Allen Park, went to Eastern Michigan University, and was told that there in the creative writing class that he had no talent whatsoever. So he started publishing his own books out of his mother's home in Allen Park, and he became one of the best-selling of the so-called popular poets in the whole United States. Finally got a contract with Prentice Hall and published a couple of editions. He went on to writing some self-help books about how to overcome depression. I brought with me this little one of his first publications that he did himself, just published it himself and took it around to bookstores and just gave poetry reading. This one is called Surviving the Loss of a Love. And everybody's gone through, hopefully, the experience of love and loving, but then sometimes it doesn't work out or it only goes on so long. And so he had a lot of sort of, you might say, self-help poetry. And it's quite clever. I actually brought him when I was part of the English department. I was also for, I guess, about 3 years, 2 or 3 years of my 14 years in the English department here at Henry Ford. I was a cultural activities director, and we actually brought films and poets in to read and be presented on campus. I was, I can't say how soundly criticized I was by my colleagues in the English department for bringing in Peter McWilliams because he was so successful. Oh, he can't be any good. And in fact, a lot of people read him and were very moved by him. And so if his work really communicates, I mean, more than just simple messages and surface meaning, then he's doing poetry. Okay, and maybe it, you know, it doesn't have all the self-conscious symbolism that, or poetic rhyme or rhythm that traditional poetry that is usually taught in academic classes has, but it's entertaining and also thought-provoking. And again, since this topic usually was love or love lost, it does strike a chord with almost everyone who gives it a try. And it's very accessible because he doesn't, as I say, doesn't have any allusions to classical mythology or things that most people wouldn't have any knowledge of. So it's easy to get involved with his writing.
I see. Now, this question just came to my head. Nowadays, basically, when you turn on a radio or something, basically, radio, all you hear is music and, you know, musical instruments and stuff like that. And even though music nowadays, they claim that they are using poetry in their music and the lyrics, but How come we don't hear poetry becoming as famous and as big as music today, where back in the days it used to be probably the key entertainment way of, you know, maybe the kings or the lovers or, you know, these examples? What would you think is the reason for that transition and that transform?
Well, there's a change in poetry in the 20th century that I think reflected the full-fledged effect of democratization of education from the beginning of the 20th century through at least 1950 or 1960. We had a lot of people who were able to read, and they did study literature, and they read a lot of books when they were growing up, whether they were forced to or not. They went to the library every week to check out books, either fiction or nonfiction, but sometimes poetry. Now, even in the schools, there's not that much literature taught, and most people don't even subscribe to a daily newspaper anymore. Children are not taught the value and the excitement of reading. Mm-hmm. In fact, solitary activity, and that's what reading is, you sit there, you stare at the page, and the words magically somehow appear in your mind. That's reading, anyway. That's rarely happens. It rarely happens. These days, children, if they're alone, they're usually doing video games.
Right.
And that's an interaction, but it has nothing to do with stimulating creativity or thoughts or touching deeper and perhaps more significant emotions within them. So I think it's the fact that we're not readers as much. We've also become conditioned to only accepting things that have a lot of stimulation, such as popular music, when seen with a music video attached to it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And to sit around reading a book, whether it's poetry or literature, is I think now is more anti-intellectualism in our society than ever before. It's anti-book, certainly, and to me that's being anti-intellectual. Mm-hmm. Books are the greatest resources out there. I'm very concerned about the digital book movement, too, with the Amazon.com Kindle electronic book, for example, and even the iPhone, which you can get book text for now. And just a cautionary tale was just a month or so ago. Kindle, since it's a wireless device, Amazon was able to go back in and pull out all of George Orwell's novels that people mm-hmm. had downloaded. Well, they discovered they didn't have the actual the rights. They had lost the publishing rights or the digital rights to them, and so they didn't just stop distributing them. They were able to go into everybody's Kindle device and erase it.
Wow.
Take it back out.
Uh-huh.
That's scary when it comes to books, because books are our heritage. We can't lose, and we can't have people tampering with them along the way.
Right.
You know, it's whether it's poetry or history or whatever, we need libraries, we need solid three-dimensional books. They should not go electronic except merely as an aid. I still think, for example, with Christmas coming up, the best present, or even Hanukkah present, that people could give would be a book to someone. Give them a book. Give them a hardbound book. If they love it, maybe it'll hold together for 30, 40 years, or they can pass it down to their children. We should not lose our books.
Hopefully that becomes a habit to people to start buying books to their children.
If I'm going to go on, you mentioned today, though, you know, there are some other things that's going on in poetry. You've perhaps heard of slam poetry
mm-hmm.
or poetry slams. That's a specialized thing that's developed in the last 10 or 15 years. And some people only perform, only write poetry and perform in those situations, so they're called slam poets. I can't mention any names, but that's where there's a live audience. There's a competition that evening, so the audience will vote, or judges will vote on what was best. The poets are usually very dynamic, which means very dramatic, that they act out the poems as sort of a, almost, it's not a, a monologue, but they're like acting out the story, but the words are more poetic than just being a story. It's more than just prose. So it's very direct statement. I have read some slam poems that are transcribed after the performance that have a great deal of merit as written poetry too.
Mm-hmm.
But slam poetry has some popularity right now among a small group of, I think, probably college-educated people, probably literature students. But nonetheless, that is going on in Detroit at least monthly somewhere. A number of slam poetry things. And then I'm interested in storytelling, but a new kind of storytelling is where you would take a short story or a nursery rhyme or a children's fairy tale and present it. But the text stays exactly the way it was written, but you present it in a powerful, dramatic way to other people
as an
oral tradition, you might say. Well, now, in fact, on WDET Radio, they have a weekly series called The Moth, and I'm not sure how the title came about, but it's a group of people that go around the country, and they were in Detroit a couple months ago, too, and did one show here, where it's they invite people up. It's like slam poetry, but it's impromptu storytelling. Well, it's kind of poetic, you know. I mean, it's special. Both slam poetry and impromptu storytelling is a combination of theatrical drama of a solo performer, of course, working with a live audience. And I should say that the traditions have varied through the years, that sometimes poetry, for example, even E.E. Cummings from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, has some poems that you can't really read them out loud. It might be a single word, but the letters of the word are broken up top to bottom on the page. And some are spaced or indented. And so you could read the word out loud. You could read it faster or slower. But in fact, it's the form or shape on the page that adds a symbolic importance to the language. That's not happening quite so much anymore. But I'm saying there was an effort to emphasize that the way it appeared on the page, whether it was capitalization or indentation or even other kinds of, whether using periods, exclamation marks, in ways that are almost pictographic rather than just the traditional way it's being used. So there were experiments and in that, and as I said, even E.E. Cummings has some poems that can't really be read and achieve anything like what they were intended to on the page itself without having, you have to look at it, you have to read it silently to yourself. Almost no one could figure out a way to read it out loud.
Thank you very much. You are listening to the Poetry Hour. This is Saf, and we are interviewing Mr. Kornick. This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves, 89.3 FM. And we are talking about poetry and poems. And Mr. Kornick has gave us a very interesting detailed explanation, or maybe not enough details, but you know, as much as we can within the hour, about poetry and poets. And we are now going into some poems. Hopefully we can hear some poems that Mr. Kornick has picked out for us, something that we are all interested in listening to. Poetry, probably.
You can let me know how time goes here, but let me just start with the poem that goes back to E.E. Cummings that can be read out loud is one that I have in the book here. Let me just get to the page. It's entitled, I Am a Beggar Always. Okay, E.E. Cummings. I am a beggar always who begs in your mind. Slightly smiling, patient, unspeaking, with a sign on his breast, blind. Yes, I am this person of whom somehow you are never wholly rid, and who does not ask for more than just enough dreams to live on. After all, kid, you might as well toss him a few thoughts, a little love preferably, anything which you can't pass off on other people, for instance, a plugged promise. Then he will maybe, hearing something fall into his hat, go wandering after it with fingers, till having found, which was thrown away, himself, tap, tap, taps out of your brain, hopes, life, to, carefully turning a corner, ever bother you anymore. That was E. Cummings.
You want to talk a little bit about it, or you think that's a self-explanatory?
Well, again, Cummings, no capital letters there except the word blind, which is all, so I read that a little louder. He talks about love, too. He's very much a love poet. In fact, many poets see things in a very negative way, and social criticism is involved of all the ugly side of life. And certainly, you can do poetry on any, you can choose any topic, any situation, and make it a poetic moment. We should not, you know, keep from the darker moments and trying to understand them. I think poetry can help us do that. But Cummings is always positive, a little bit cynical around the edge, but he's also sort of tentative or shy when it comes to relationships. I like that. I think he's, you know, gentle, soft, and so on. Let's do something that's similar to that. Robert Creeley, I met in the late 1960s in California, and he, in many ways, seemed to, his style comes from E.E. Cummings and others, and I have two poems here. Let's see. And maybe you can hear some of this. This is called The Rhythm by Robert Creeley. That's C-R-E-E-L-E-Y. It is all a rhythm, from the shutting door to the window opening, the seasons, the sun's light, the moon, the oceans, the growing of things, the mind in men personal, recurring in them again, thinking the end is not the end, the time returning, themselves dead but someone else coming. If in death I am dead, then in life also, dying, dying, and the women cry and die, the little children grow only to old men, the grass dries, the force goes, but is met by another returning. Oh, not mine, not mine, and in turn dies. The rhythm which projects from itself continuity, bending all to its force from window to door, from ceiling to floor, light at the opening, dark at the closing.
That was nice.
Maybe you can sense that, but Cummings and Creeley, there is some rhyming, internal rhyming, not necessarily at the end of the lines, but they do some rhymes, and that also makes it interesting to listen to, pricks up your ears, and fascinates you with the meaning of words that sound the same coming closely together.
If you probably ask people nowadays about poetry, they're probably the only thing that they can think about is rhyming.
Yeah, that's. And most, again, most song lyrics rhyme, so that's about as far as it usually goes. In fact, there's usually pretty dull or disastrous exercises if they're teaching poetry, I think, the wrong way, let's say in high school or elementary school. All they're teaching is the rhyming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting little exercise, but it won't do much to get people to think favorably of and enjoy poetry. When I taught it at English here, since we had so many sections, a colleague of mine was also teaching it, a great professor, but his approach was you can learn to write poetry through imitation of the great forms and traditions and styles of the people who were already great poets.
Uh-huh.
And so he only allowed students to use the patterns of poems that he already presented to them.
Right.
So they had to, you know, imitation, they say, is flattery, but it's if the poet's already dead, I'm not sure what that matters. Well, some people like to learn to explore their creativity within those sort of boundaries. I was usually in my classes wide open, just allowing people to explore whatever they wanted to, I would try to let them see what already had been done, but to try to get them to speak clearly and plainly in their own voice, but as strongly as they could with the best words that they could choose. Anyway, let's see where we are here. I'd like to switch to a poet that's very accessible and still rhymed a little bit too, Richard Brautigan. He also passed away a few years ago, tragically, but he was kind of a hippie or a beatnik before there even was such things, that he wore long hair and little granny glasses and all kinds of clothes from used clothes shops. And that was in the 50s before, you know, before there even was a movement in Greenwich Village. So he was always sort of an outsider, an individualist. And he was obviously greatly influenced by haiku, the short Japanese form of poetry, as well as E.E. Cummings, too. And it's an interesting thing that his works have been translated. Again, his name is Brautigan, B-R-A-U-T-I-G-A-N, Richard Brautigan. His works of poetry have been translated into 15 different languages around the world, but also his books of poetry have been translated into 8 different languages. So he's written prose and poems, but the point is, if your poetry is translatable, and that's an amazing thing, I think. In other words, it sort of transcends the culture itself.
Of course.
Well, here's just a few examples, and I find these a lot of fun, too. This is from a collection of his, Richard Brautigan, from 1968. And it's entitled The Pill Versus the Spring Hill Mine Disaster, which is one of the poems in here, but I'm not going to read that one. Here's a very optimistic thing. Sounds very E.E. Cummings to me. All watched over by machines of loving grace. I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony, like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now, please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think, it has to be, of a cybernetic ecology where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace.
Cool.
Yeah, that's almost too optimistic. World robot domination coming soon. Watch out, Terminator, all that.
Right.
Here's an example of extremely simple direct poetry that still has sort of a haiku feel to it. And let me just explain haiku. That's H-A-I-K-U for people that are taking notes. I wrote one down real quickly just to give you an idea of how intense it could be. And, of course, it's not in Japanese, and it kind of fits the style and form. So listen to Koronik's haiku here, which is just a demonstration. And then we'll listen to Richard Brautigan. So here's my haiku. Springtime. A frog sits beside a pond. Kerplunk!
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, what happens in a haiku, usually they begin by evoking the season, a season, one of the four. Okay. Uh-huh. In this case, I used the word springtime itself, but they would talk like cherry blossoms. Well, cherry blossoms only bloom in one season, spring, I believe, and so that would get that across to people. Now, the frog sits beside a pond, so there's something you can visualize. That's something in the real world.
Right.
But then the haiku tries to surprise you at the end. Kerplunk! That's the sound of something falling into the water.
Right.
The frog!
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, he jumped. He was there, not doing anything, and all of a sudden, boom! So it's like a Buddha moment.
Uh-huh.
Do you know anything about Buddhism? Buddha... it actually means, I understand, he who woke up. And that moment of waking up all of a sudden, of having a great awareness or a great insight, sometimes in the Judeo-Christian religion is called an epiphany. James Joyce used to believe that even his short stories and sometimes his novels would have moments of that strong awareness that would just overcome you, just flood into your brain and all through your body. And that's what haiku tries to do at the end, is trying to wake you up, even though it's not a Buddhist form. It's not talked about or practiced in the Buddhist religion. All there is such a thing as Zen Buddhism, but we won't go into that. So listen to some of these short poems from Richard Brautigan from the late 60s.
For those who are just tuning in, thank you for tuning in, and you are listening to the Poetry Hour with Seth, and we are joined by Mr. Kornick on the WHFR.FM, the station making waves. We are here listening to some more poems, and I hope you are enjoying this.
Okay, this one from Richard Brautigan is entitled The She Never Takes Her Watch Off Poem.
All
those words are written together. Okay, The She Never Takes Her Watch Off Poem for Marcia. Because you always have a clock strapped to your body, it's natural that I should think of you as the correct time. With your long blonde hair at 8:03, and your pulse-lightening breast at 11:17, and your rose-meow smile at 5:30, I know I'm right. Yeah, you have to imagine it's a Zen thing. Okay,
you
have to
you out there, huh?
Imagine the clock and the clock face,
12
at the top and so on, and imagine the girl. And okay, this one is very Zen-like. It almost demands that you stare at the page. It's entitled Karma Repair Kit. So there's your dharma, your duty in life, and your karma is how you get to the dharma, I think. Whatever, this talks about what you should do with your life. So Karma Repair Kit. If you've got trouble with your karma, listen to this. Items 1 through 4 from Richard Brautigan. Number 1, get enough food to eat and eat it. Number 2, find a place to sleep where it is quiet and sleep there. Number 3, reduce intellectual and emotional noise until you arrive at the silence of yourself and listen to it. Number 4. That's it. That's why you got to see the page is blank. In other words, you just got to think about it. You've got to participate in this yourself. You can't fix your fate or your duty or your activities day to day unless you jump in there too. Still, it's cool that he also suggested that we're careful what we eat, we get enough sleep, and we try to find a point of silence too. And then point number 4, well, just get involved. Do it.
I see.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here's another example. This is an example of a found poem, supposedly. A found poem is when you find words written on something somewhere, and you're not sure of the context, although I'm going to describe where he found it here, and you just repeat it.
Uh-huh.
And he has his own comment at the end. So San Francisco is the title of the poem, and he says here, this poem was found written on a paper bag by Richard Brautigan in a laundromat in San Francisco. The author is unknown. By accident, you put your money in my machine, number 4. By accident, I put my money in another machine, number 6. On purpose, I put your clothes in the empty machine full of water and no clothes. It was lonely. Yeah, you just got to think about that. Okay. There we go. We're on a roll now. Let me know if we're running out of time.
Don't forget to jump into the local artist.
Ah, yes. I'll read something from Peter McWilliams. Yes. Absolutely. Here's one that's more fully developed, a metaphor, if you will, simile. It's quite common for many poets to take an abstraction and try to develop some concrete situation in the real world. You can tell by the title here that that's what Richard Brautigan is trying to do. Death is a beautiful car parked only for Emmett. Death is a beautiful car parked only to be stolen on a street lined with trees whose branches are like the intestines of an emerald. You hotwire death, get in, and drive away like a flag made from 1,000 burning funeral parlors. You have stolen death because you're bored. There's nothing good playing at the movies in San Francisco. You joyride around for a while listening to the radio, and then abandon death. Walk away and leave death for the police to find.
Interesting.
Yeah,
nice way of thinking.
A lot of specific things. And you say, well, it doesn't all make sense. I won't repeat them. But in the context, I think we can see that, okay, the parked car on this tree-lined street, San Francisco, he's saying it is death. It is death. And we like to dabble. We like to risk our lives while we're alive. We'd like to get close to it, take it out for a test drive. But wisely, we don't stay with it. We abandon it and come back to this real life. It is kind of risky, and then let the police find it and return death to its proper place or whatever. I think that's kind of clever. Let me just see if there's... I've got to read just one more then. From Brodigan, and then we'll do a couple Peter McWilliams.
All right.
If we got time. Very short stuff here. Here's one that obviously is haiku-like from Brodigan. It's entitled Haiku Ambulance. A piece of green pepper fell off the wooden salad bowl. So what?
So what?
There you go. Yeah. See, I made you think, didn't I? Okay. And last here, told you these were short. November 3rd, also from Richard Brodigan. I'm sitting in a cafe, drinking a Coke. A fly is sleeping on a paper napkin. I have to wake him up so I can wipe my glasses. There's a pretty girl I want to look at. Okay. Cool. Now, again, a lot of my colleagues in the English department will currently say, there's nothing there. But I think there is. I think there's a lot going on there. It touches at a single moment in a sort of a microscope is examining a single moment of time and the importance of the simplest things and the importance of timing, too. That makes all the difference. I think. Okay.
Can you become a poetry critic by just being one, or do you really have to go through what you had to do through education?
Well, I think a good critic has to take into account a lot of the things that have already been done in that same literary genre. I don't think you can be a good critic if you don't have anything to compare it to. Mm-hmm. Oh, we all know what we like or don't like for maybe no reason at all that we can figure out. Those sort of subjective things are meaningful to relate to other people, but they can't totally get involved with what you have talked about because they don't have a frame of reference. They are not you. You are not them. They are not you, coo-coo-coo-choo, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I think a good critic is able to express their opinion, which may be based in emotion as well as intellect, and can argue, maybe sometimes in a less than poetic way, about why they had that experience, the depth of that experience. And that may allow other people, not necessarily, to also have a similar experience upon... experiencing the work for the first time or again. So I think that's what a critic's job is, to find the good stuff, to mm-hmm. recommend it, and to give reasons for why they consider it superior to other things that are out there. And I don't think you can do that if you just haven't read much or experienced much of what's out there. Okay. Peter McWilliams from Allen Park, Michigan, in the 1970s, had most of his success here and also worldwide. He also wrote some books about transcendental meditation, too, mm-hmm. that he felt that was useful for him, just like Zen Buddhist meditation was useful for some of the beatnik poets like Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg, that he felt that finding that still place could pull your thoughts and your ideas together, but with all the distractions of normal modern life, you wouldn't have a chance of getting to that stillness unless you really worked hard at it. So anyway, okay. This volume is all on surviving the loss of a love, and it is sort of a poetry cycle from beginning to the end. I like just a couple here. You cannot come into my life again. Don't try to enter my mind with your eyes. It won't work. I am impenetrable, aloof, friendly, but distant, kind, but cold. This time you haven't a chance. Still, your 10-minute visit will cause me 10 days of pain. How hard the forgetting, how easy the remembering, how cruel the process that possesses me. So this is his suffering part. I'm a few pages into his breakup here. Next poem, next page even, from Peter McWilliams. The ancient Chinese had a torture in which water was dripped onto a person's face, drop by drop. I know this torture well. The torture of the thousand tears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe a lot of people relate to the poetry with love. A lot of people would like to get into their lover's heart by using poetry and such thing.
Well, you know, a grief shared is half a grief, perhaps. it does help to talk or think about others' deep experiences and see how you relate to them or they to you. It's also difficult, for some people, to find the right words for their feelings, and it helps them when they can discover perhaps a poem that expresses how they feel, and it shows them the context and maybe even a helpful way to grapple with that difficulty. Okay, let me do another one here from Peter McWilliams. Now this is, you know, I talked about magical incantation. This may seem repetitive, but I think it really works, so give me a break here. Okay, this is, and give Peter McWilliams a break. Again, he's about halfway through his cycle of despair for the breakup of his relationship here. I must give you up. 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 I must survive. I must give you up. 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 I must give you up.
Wow. What a way, huh?
Now, of course, the sheer repetition of certain words, some poets use repetition more than others. It's certainly used in many religious rituals to repeat a certain phrase over and over again to increase its power or understandability or whatever.
Yes. So maybe we can listen to the last one and close with that,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that we are at the top of the hour.
Okay, very good. Well, he pulls himself out of it by the end of this collection anyway, and so this is Peter McWilliams, and one of his final thoughts in his book, Surviving the Loss of a Love. I am joy. I am everything. I can do all things but two. Number one, forget that I love you. Number two, forget that you no longer love me.
Ouch.
Well, we have to deal with, you know, our past, put it in perspective, and we can't really forget it, you know.
Right.
And just have to know how to deal with it. So.
Exactly, and that's poetry for you.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to the Poetry Hour on the one and only WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And this is your boy, Saf, with Mr. Jay Kornack. Thank you very much for listening and tuning in. And we hope to entertain you again on the next hour. Thank you very much, and you have a great day. Goodbye.
50101 is open for your dining pleasure in the Student and Culinary Arts Center on Henry Ford Community College's main campus in Dearborn. 50101 offers a fresh, innovative approach to fine dining with all entrees made from the freshest ingredients, with weekly specialties highlighting different countries and cultures. For hours of operation or to make reservations, please call 313-206-5101. That's 313-206-5101. 5101, an elegant dining experience at an affordable price.
Wow, I can't believe it. This is great news.
Aw, thanks. Oh, I'm so nervous, but I'm excited, too.
So are you going to start telling people? Is it too soon?
I think I'll wait a little bit, you know, just in case.
Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah. Well, people are going to notice soon anyway.
Have you told your mom yet?
Not yet.
Oh, she's going to be so happy.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be so nice to finally be able to say, I am quitting smoking.
Mm. Congratulations.
Thank you.
If you're pregnant, there's one more exciting announcement you can make to your friends and family, that you've decided to quit smoking. A lot of women are able to quit successfully when they find out they're pregnant. They have the best motivation there is, a healthy baby. Deciding to quit is the first step you can take to reduce the risks of premature delivery, low birth weight, childhood asthma, and SIDS. We can help you learn to quit. Call Great Start at 1-866-66-START.
So do I have to buy you a gift for this too?
Of course.
Every baby deserves a great start. Brought to you by the American Legacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
I'm Chris Moore on WHFR, Dearborn. Thanks for listening.
WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I am Jeff, and thank you so much for tuning in today. You're listening to One Chord to Another, where for the next 2 hours, I'll be playing a mix of indie rock and pop, but this week is going to be a little bit different of a show, because I'm going to be playing some Christmas music. I might be throwing some regular indie rock and pop in there as well, but it's definitely going to be a lot of Christmas music, kind of like the music that I started the show out with. This is music from the Chronicles of Narnia soundtrack, actually, and it's a song called Father Christmas. It's got a real great Christmas sound to it, so I figured I'd start the show out with that today, kind of give me something to talk over. So, but yeah, today's going to be all about Christmas, Christmas traditions, Christmas, just Christmas, 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 all sorts of different things. And I've just recently came across Suburban Sprawl's Christmas compilation that they put out this year. So I'm